short information for our English listeners. There will be a short introduction in German, but the rest of the episode will be entirely in English, so just keep going. Ja, hallo liebe Kulturpessimist*innen-Fans. Hier ist ein kleines Neujahrs-Special, ein kleines Interview von mir, dem Christopher. Erik und Becky sind nicht da, aber im Geiste bei uns. Ja, dieses Interview, was jetzt folgt, wollte ich eigentlich schon seit 4 Jahren machen mit Donnerka. Donnerka betreibt die Webseite filmgrab.com, wo er mehr oder weniger jeden Tag eine Auswahl von Filmstills aus Filmen veröffentlicht. Und ja, das ist so sein Hauptwerk, dass er quasi eine Sammlung von hochwertigen und kuratierten Filmstills aussucht und sich natürlich sehr viel in dem Prozess mit Kamera, Szenenstellung, Requisite, Kostüm beschäftigt. Und ich fand es einfach spannend, war eine spannende Idee, so eine Seite als Vorrat für Filmschaffende, für Filmfans wie uns anzulegen. Ich besuche die Seite selber sehr gerne und ja, wir wollten seit mehr oder weniger 4 Jahren schon mal über seine Arbeit reden. Das haben wir im letzten Sommer geschafft. Und ja, das erscheint jetzt als kleines Neujahrs-Special. Donnerka kommt aus Irland, deswegen wird das gesamte Interview in Englisch sein. Aber ich hoffe, dass ihr trotzdem Spaß dran haben werdet. Und wenn nicht, kommt ja bald auch wieder eine reguläre Folge in Deutsch. Also dann, viel Spaß beim Interview. So, welcome to this special episode, this special interview episode. I have here with me in our virtual podcast studio, Donnerka from filmgrab.com. Hello, Donnerka.
Hello, how's it going?
Fine, thanks. I hope you're as well feeling good with the weather and anything.
Yeah, feeling good. I've spent the day working on my house, so I'm covered in dust at the moment. I'll get a shower after this interview.
Very well. So, quick background. So, we wanted to do this interview, I think, for the last 4 years on and off.
Yeah.
But it never happened on my part since I took some time off from podcasting and then you had some things to do. I think you moved in the last four
years.
Yes,
I moved. So, I'm from Ireland, but I'm living in France now, in rural France, working on a house. So, that takes a lot of energy and focus. So I'm so glad this is happening finally.
Yes, I follow your work since 4 or 5 years, and I'm very fascinated with the things you do, you collect, you edit. This interview is all about your work, how you came to it, what you're doing currently, how it works technically, and a bit about the philosophical side of movies.
Okay.
Let's start just with the beginning. So, can you remember when you started to be interested in movies, or interested in movies beyond the average moviegoer?
Well, my father showed me Jaws younger than I watched it when I was too young, and ended up being afraid of any water, being afraid in the bath, being afraid in a swimming pool. I always thought there'd be a shark there. So I love Jaws from a young age. I'm actually, funnily enough, wearing a Jaws t-shirt at the moment.
Oh,
but
nice.
Then when I was younger, anytime people asked me what I would want to become, it was a lawyer. And then I'm glad I didn't become a lawyer, because they're not the best of people. But I eventually realized we have a year in school in Ireland between the two big exams. They have a year where you get to try other things. And I ended up spending most of that time just watching movies, falling in love with movies. So I realized that I didn't want to be a lawyer. I just loved courtroom movies. Mm-hmm. I loved lawyers in movies. So eventually I got over that and I just started loving all kinds of movies. I remember one time, probably that year or maybe the year before, I used to videotape movies off the TV, and I would rent movies a lot. And I remember one time I rented American Pie and American Beauty on the same weekend. And I thought American Pie was funny. I was 13 or 14. And then American Beauty, something about it, it was funny as well. And I know it's cool to hate on that movie now. I haven't watched it in many years. But something about American Beauty, I went, okay, there's more going on here. A movie doesn't have to be just a comedy or an action movie or a horror movie. It can be something more than that. So that moment kind of opened a lot of possibilities for me, I think.
So how old were you then? So if you say last years of school, like 16, 17 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so I think I was probably 15 to 16. Mm-hmm. And in that year, your traditional subjects aren't so important. It's more important mm-hmm. that you study the things you didn't study in your traditional course. So you would do, if you didn't do woodwork or home economics or art or whatever, you would do that. But you didn't have so much homework. And I just used all that free time to watch movies. So I think that was maybe 2005, 2006, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I started watching all the movies that 15 and 16 year old boys love to watch. So Pulp Fiction, all mm-hmm. the Tarantino stuff, and Seven and Kubrick and all that, Scorsese, all that good entry level stuff.
Mm-hmm. So just to understand, because I think many of our listeners don't understand or don't know the Irish school system. So you were still in school and you're still preparing for your final school exams, or was this after school in preparation for uni or college or something?
So
like that?
So what happens in Irish schools is there's two big exams. One you do when you're 15 in your third year of school, and that's called a junior certificate. Mm-hmm. And then you do two more years and you do the leaving certificate. And the leaving certificate is very stressful because it affects what college you get into, what course you get into. So there's an optional year you can do after the junior certificate. Some people choose to skip it. They just want to get out of school as soon as possible, but mm-hmm. other people want to explore other options. And for me, it was so important just having the time to spend watching movies and falling in love with movies was so important.
Mm-hmm. So it was a very formative year for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. very much so. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. So, I stick to the school system stuff, but I find it very interesting. So after the final exam, you directly go to college, or can you spend some time there in between, or you just go directly to the next school?
So traditionally, you just go straight. Some people take a year out, but I went straight from that into college. And my course was it was called Media Arts. Mm-hmm. So it was a chance to study film, not just film, but radio production, TV production, theory as well, philosophy, yeah, a lot of things. When I was in college, I very stupidly, my dissertation in college was a defense of Gus Van Sant's remake of Psycho, and my lecturer, I love it, I think it's a great movie, but my lecturer hated it and hated me for even suggesting it was good or there was value in it.
Very controversial.
Yes, I've always been a controversial person, I think.
So do you have some big points from this dissertation? So what was your main argument?
My main argument was that it really did fit within Van Sant's career, where He's always been interested in taking familiar imagery and familiar stories and structures and reformatting them, redefining them. So if you look at something like My Own Private Idaho, which takes a lot from some Shakespeare play, I think it's Richard the Third, I guess, or no, whatever Falstaff Chimes at Midnight is. But basically, like Van Sant, when he had a big, big success with Good Will Hunting, he kind of had a blank check within Hollywood and could make whatever he wanted. And this was what he wanted to make. He wanted, and it wasn't just specifically Psycho. He just wanted to do the experiment of, can you do a shot for shot remake of a movie and change the context, change how you feel about the characters, change nothing but change everything. And I just thought it was very, very interesting. And slowly now, since I wrote it, I don't want to say I was ahead of my time, but I've seen this year a few people coming to its defense. They're finally realizing, like, I think when it came out, a lot of people, why would someone do that? Why would someone do that? There's no originality, but to me, it was the most original thing to not change a thing. He wasn't trying to make a film that was as scary as Psycho or as shocking as Psycho. He was trying to see what happens when you show someone a film that they've seen already, that they're already so familiar with, and challenge them in interesting ways.
I think I need to see the movie now. Just checked it. I think the only movie I ever saw from Gus Van Sant was Elephant.
Elephant's great. Yeah.
Yeah, and it also takes something familiar like school and twists it in a very disturbing way. I think I saw it in school. It was for a school like afternoon workshop about philosophy, wow, where we watched it. I think it was in wake of some school shooting in Germany. We luckily don't have
intense.
We don't have as many as in the US.
Yes,
but we had some, and I think it was actually with our school director who said, "Okay, we need to watch it and talk about this topic." And so it wasn't wake, not directly after it, of course, but I think some year or something where we watched it and talked about the motifs in it. Yeah, but I think it's very interesting. In my own like film bubble, we also have oftentimes discussion about movies who are considered in the mainstream bad, but we find them very good. For example, the last couple of years, I had a really come around for the Wachowski sisters. And, I really love their movies like Speed Racer. And I also love Jupiter Ascending for their satirical motives. So most people think that Jupiter Ascending is just a stupid sci-fi flick, but if you look at it, you see a lot of I just know the German title here, Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, sure.
They really took some motives from that book. So I'm really a big fan of people who are leaping to the defense of mainstream bad movies and show that they have good topics.
Yeah, well, maybe it's good, but maybe if you ever have to write a dissertation, go with something easier.
So let's go ahead. You mentioned your job. So I saw on the IMDb that I don't know if it's you, but Sam Donaka Coffey has.
Yeah, no, there's only one. There's only one Donaka Coffey.
There's only one. So I guess after university, you started in the filmmaking business.
Yes. So I was working in and around Dublin, mainly. I was working partly on my own projects, some which got finished and I was happy with, and some which never got finished, but I learned a lot from. But I was working a lot as a director of photography on independent films. And that's kind of where Film Grab was born, because if you were working as a DP, first things first is you get a script and then you meet up with the director and to talk about the style and the look. And inevitably, just the way my brain works, I would be looking at a script and I would say, oh, what if we did it? Have you seen this movie? Have you seen that movie? And sometimes they would have seen it and sometimes not. But I had a huge, huge DVD collection, too many DVDs. And I would find myself regularly going to my DVDs and pulling images from them just to send them to the director or to whoever might be looking for a set. This is the kind of thing we are looking for. So eventually I was sitting on a small collection that was just for me of those images, and I decided I'd put them up online. And that's really where the Film Grab started. It was just an idea. I didn't think it would turn into anything else, but people seem to like it. So I'm here, stuck here more than 10 years later, still working on it.
You started with Film Grab in 2010 then, or when did it first online?
I think maybe even 2009 I started it, maybe. It was such an offhanded idea. I didn't think much about it. Oh, I'll just do this for a while and it's there. Some people might like it. So I kept on working in films, and then I had two films that I had written myself. And when it came around time to shoot them, everything that could go wrong went wrong. It was a terrible, terrible experience. It kind of put me off making movies for a while. And at that exact same time, my friend was starting a website for music performances. Film is one of my passions, but my other passion is music. So I ended up helping a lot on that. And that got bigger and bigger and bigger and took a lot of time. I think between 2010 and 2012, I think I maybe shot 300 different performances, like small acoustic performances and full band performances, and I did all the editing. But we had a lot of people working on that website, and I would spend all my time on that. But I would keep going back to Film Grab just to, is that still there? Is that still going? Should I do some more? And the visitors to the site kept on going up and up and up. And I went, okay, I need to put a bit more time into this. So when we finished on that project, I went back to Film Grab and stuck with it.
The site was basically, as a band, I can book you to shoot our performance, or was it like
that? Well, no, we found musicians that we liked, and if they were coming, maybe half of them were Irish musicians that we loved and wanted to highlight, and half of them were, you know, Americans or English musicians coming through Dublin. They would play a gig at 8 o'clock in Dublin, but at 5 o'clock, they would be filming with us backstage, or we would go out and find an interesting place to shoot them. And a lot of really good experiences. We even went in 2011, we went to South by Southwest in Austin, and I shot 30 bands in 3 days or 4 days, I guess. A lot of good memories.
And but this website doesn't exist anymore, or you don't do that anymore?
The site doesn't exist, but all the videos are still up on YouTube. It's called Cock and Bull TV. Yeah, if people want to check out some of that stuff, I'm still proud of it. I'll still even go back, and some of my favorite performances are from that, and I can remember them so clearly. And even if I listen to the same song on the musician's album, it doesn't hit the same as that performance. But I'm biased, so, you know.
Did you notice that your work at FilmGrab influenced your work at the music video business?
I guess so. I was told a lot that the videos were good quality videos. The musicians seemed to like them a lot, and I think at the time, just from watching so much, it influences your eye and what you're interested in looking at. So I guess around the time of Cockin, when I was doing all that, I was probably watching a lot of new wave, French Nouvelle Vague, and even German new wave, Fassbinder and Wim Wenders and Herzog. So I guess they're a little influenced by that, but I mean, it's the main energy of those videos was very much on the fly. Like sometimes you would only have 20 minutes with a musician because they have to go. So you really just have to get it right the first time. And a lot of times there are imperfections, that the camera shakes or you don't have the right angle at the right time, but you do it anyway, I guess. And I guess that was the biggest influence.
You said you watched a lot of Nouvelle Vague films in this time and Wim Wenders. Do you notice that you have phases on which style of cinematography you do at some times? Or is it like you jump a lot and you don't have any direction at some time?
When I find a director I like or that interests me, I will try and watch as much of their films in a short period of time. So at the moment, I'm just starting to watch the Dardenne brothers movies. But yeah, I go through phases. Like a few years ago, all I wanted to do was watch spaghetti westerns or giallo movies. Yeah, I go through phases, and eventually I go as far as I can and find, oh, who's this guy? And you learn even the actors, you get familiar with the actors that keep popping up. And so Fassbinder was really interesting for me because he worked with a lot of the same people. And then when you run out of Fassbinder, which is hard to do because he worked so much, then you can find Werner Schroeder movies that use a lot of the same cast as well. So it's like catching up with old friends.
Yeah, so it's always the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So when you stop with the director, you can go with any other collaborator.
Exactly. Everything's connected.
But you always follow the director. You don't find a movie from a DOP and then go through the whole work of the DOP, or how do you work there?
Usually I start with a director because it's the clearest line, because a lot of director of photography's, maybe half of their work is really great. They work on masterpieces, but then half of the time they're just working on jobs just for a paycheck, I guess. Mm. And so you find that they're not always proud of all of the work. So I start with directors, but there are DPs like, I think Benoit Deby, he's a French DP. Everything he shot is just masterful. So, yeah, I have a few DPs that whatever they're involved with, I will make sure that I track down.
So with the DPs, it's oftentimes just the craft that they are providing for the director, and the artistic vision and the images are more the work of a director than a DP, who oftentimes only does what the director says. Or is there any formula how much of the images in a movie come from the director and how much from the DOP?
It's so hard to say. It's so hard to say, but I think even the most skilled DPs and the most skilled directors also are working within limitations of time and budget. Sometimes two people working together have very different styles and they might not mesh. But it's hard to say. For me, when I follow a director, it's because the more I watch, and especially the more I watch kind of close together, the more of an idea of who this person is comes true, like what they're interested in, what visually and narratively and thematically as well. So directors that have a big body of work, someone like Fassbinder or even Godard, who mm-hmm. just doesn't seem to stop working and has so many different phases to his work, like the early works and then the Ziga Vertov movies and then back to traditional filmmaking, but it's never been traditional. But anyway, all that to say, yeah, I like to learn about an artist just by consuming as much of their work as possible.
Mm-hmm. Do you follow other collaborators as well? Like I think for image in a movie to work, you need people like set designers and costume designers,
production design.
Yeah,
Just maybe in the last 2 years, I just started crediting production designers and costume designers. Ideally, I would credit everyone, but you if you want to see everyone's credit, you can just go to
IMDb.
But yeah, crediting the production designers and the costume designers meant I was finally seeing, oh, the same person worked on this and this. That's why it looks like this. And you find all these amazing kind of hidden artists who don't get the proper credit, I guess. Because we do just mainly talk about directors when movies are so much more than just a director's vision.
I really find it fascinating how, like you said, DOPs wander from movie to movie, and oftentimes it's just a paycheck. The last time I really was surprised was that I think Bill Pope did Clueless and The Matrix in the same year or year after year. So I think Clueless is also a very good movie in its own right, but I feel it very interesting that he went from Clueless to The Matrix very fast and did both movies very well. And I really find it fascinating where Bill Pope pops up as a DOP. He has a really very broad palette of work.
Yeah. That can be really interesting to explore, especially when someone he also did like the Spider-Man movies, I guess the first two Raimi movies, and he works with Edgar Wright now as well. So he has very specific talents for crafting images, and I think you only get a full sense of that if you're able to look back at everything, and that's what my favorite thing about the website. My favorite thing is when I post and make a new post, and suddenly you can click on the director and there's seven different movies from them, and you can click on the DP and there's 10 different movies from it. Creating those connections allows you to explore the films, I guess.
Yeah, this hidden connections, that's...
Yeah.
I think that's very similar to working as a historian, like I did, where you at one point then you see the hidden bigger picture of like, say, Russia the last 200 years. Where you see, okay, it started not with the Soviet Union, but with Napoleon. And okay, there this happened. And you see suddenly the big connections that you don't see if you just stick to a very little time period.
And,
I really love and such things happens. Let's go to the technical side. So you said you started in 2009. Maybe you can tell something about how you started to actually collect the images, and maybe how your technique evolved over the last 10 years.
Well, yeah, it's always evolving. The big thing is I mainly use completely free software to build the website, to grab the images. So I use VLC, which is a really great open source video player. I was able to set that up so my shortcuts were I could press a key and move forward one frame or move back one frame and press a key and create a snapshot. So yeah, I was at the start, I was mainly working off DVDs. I had a huge collection, and eventually that spread up to Blu-rays as Blu-rays became more popular. And now, because there's so much streaming, I'm using streaming as a source. But so what I do is traditionally we'll have seen the film at some point, but usually I will try and do the grabbing very soon after seeing it. So I'll watch through the film once without worrying about doing anything. I'm just watching it to enjoy it and appreciate it as its own piece of art. And then I'll watch through it again at a faster speed. I'm not listening to it. I'm just looking for the images and remembering the pacing of the film. So at the end of that process, once I've watched through the film, there could be anywhere from maybe 60 to, if I was doing something like, I think the most I ever grabbed was when I was doing the Tree of Life, Terrence Malick's movie. I think I had maybe 500 images or 600 images. So then you just start editing. And what I'm looking to do when I edit is basically to get a full sense of the film in as few images as possible. So if there's 10 amazing close-ups in my 500 images, 10 amazing close-ups of Jessica Chastain, well, I only really need the one perfect close-up. And so I'll take that shot and get rid of the rest, or the same with landscapes, or some scenes might have 10 amazing setups in the whole scene, but you can actually get the kernel of the idea with just two images. So just edit down. I use free software as well, like to DVDs often come with black bars at the top and bottom or at the sides. So just crop them out, and then they're ready to go up online. And, yeah, that's my process. So I usually say if a film is up on the site, it represents maybe about 5 hours of work for me. Mm-hmm. And that includes just watching the movie one time for fun. But
okay, so if a movie is like, say, 2 hours long, you have 3 hours of just work to collect the images, to crop them and upload them.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just the annoying stuff of just making sure everything is tagged correctly. And that's my least favorite part of the job, but it the has archiving. To be done too. Yeah.
I also know that. So it has to be done, but it's not very fun.
Yeah, exactly. It's a necessity.
Yes. So how many movies do you per year or per month? So have you a rim, or what's your goal for a year? How does this work?
So my main goal is to do one movie a day, and that's just posting up on the site. So I think for the most part, for the last maybe 5 years, there's been one new movie every day. Last month or two, I've just been trying to clear a backlog because I've actually done too much work. So I've just been trying to post as much as possible. So some days I posted 4 or 5 different movies. But in general, what I'm planning to do is for as long as possible, every day you can visit the site, there will be at least one new film up there.
That's a hell of a rim, I think. So
And it comes in batches. So mm-hmm. So I do other stuff as well. Like I'm working on this house at the moment, and that's a lot of work. So some days I don't watch anything. I don't watch any movies. I'm too busy with other projects. But then other days, when I'm not so busy, I might end up watching four movies in a day, which is maybe too much. But what are you gonna do?
I did that the day before yesterday. Because I'm on vacation, and I just, so I have my own personal currently phase is that I watch a lot of submarine movies. I have a list of movies that I want to get through, and then day before yesterday I watched Black Sea with Jude Law, and then
I haven't seen it yet.
I really like it. It's like a heist movie with a submarine, like Ocean's 11 in a submarine.
Okay.
I really like it. And then I say, okay, what is the shortest movie on my list? And that was Atomic Submarine from 1954. And it was really, really bad, but it was just 17 minutes. So and then in the evening with my girlfriend, I think I watched The Rider from Chloe Zhao.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah, yeah. I was really surprised how well this movie was received in 2018. I think it was really the indie movie darling from that year.
Yeah.
And then Princess Mononoke to close the day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good way to close the day.
Yeah.
A bit of Ghibli.
Yeah. Since I started working in 2018, I don't watch as many movies. But while I was studying, I tried every beginning of the year. I say, okay, this year I watch a movie a day. And you can make it. It's just 2 hours per day. You have to at least 2 hours per day. But then you want to watch series or go out or something like that. And it never worked for me. I think the best I did was some 200 movies a year. That really took work. But if you say you watch at least a movie a day, you easily go over 360 movies a year.
Yeah. And then some days you just end up, there's nothing else to do and it's miserable outside, so why not just spend a day catching up on but it's really good. Like I think it's really good to have like a project like you were saying, watching submarine movies. Mm-hmm. I think that's it. That's really interesting. And it would make me watch movies I didn't necessarily want to or never would have gotten around to. So I do the same, but just with directors. So I'll go, this is my Wim Wenders season, so I'm just going to watch
it. It's the season of Wim Wenders. So so in the German film Twitter bubble, there are a lot of like challenges or thematic months. Like you have the Japanerary, where you watch a lot of Japanese movies. And I personally started also a thematic month in the December to watch movies from the former film studio of the GDR. So because it's Defa-Zember, so Defa was the name of the studio, and it works well with the German December, it's very interesting because it's in Germany known for their fairy tale movies. They did a lot of there, but they also have a very good dramatic movies about the post-war period, about living in the GDR. They have a lot of movies that they're banned until the end of the GDR. I really like them, and it's like I said, always a great way to discover movies that you wouldn't have watched otherwise. So some people started to loathe those challenges because they say, yeah, you don't need to have a challenge to watch movies. But at the same time, you have so many movies to pick from, and how do you make the pick?
It just makes it easier to choose. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes it easier to choose what film you're going to watch. If you have a list and it says, okay, next I'm watching this, then you don't waste. Because I know so much of my time is wasted when, is there anything good on Netflix? Oh my God, it's so hard to search through. So
yes.
When I have a pile ready, okay, I'm just watching this next and this next and this next. And it is dangerous. Sometimes you can get into the mindset of, you're not fully appreciating it, but mm-hmm. when it works really well.
Yeah. For the same reason, I really love a festival where you can just book a festival ticket and then just sit the whole afternoon in the cinema and then watch one movie after another. That's a really good way to discover movies you also can't see on the internet, like movies who are really old or really obscure, only exist in film. And
that won't get released properly. Yeah.
So you said you always use free software, you use VLC, you upload it onto your website. Do you always try to get the Blu-ray version of a movie, or if you, like, say, a Netflix movie who doesn't necessarily exist on Blu-ray or any physical
media? On Blu-ray, yeah. So with the streaming ones, it's getting more difficult. And finally now, I just see this week Disney have stopped producing Blu-rays, so the future is definitely streaming, but I always try and find the best available, the best quality available to me, but sometimes it's not always possible. I still have, from my huge DVD collection, I still have movies I haven't even gotten around to watch. I bought them maybe 10 years ago and I never watched them yet, so but sometimes when you watch a DVD, you go, okay, that's the quality isn't so good. As best as possible, you can get, yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you just then load it up in VLC. And for example, like Netflix, I know there are some hidden settings you can activate to get the best stream. But then you just do a screen cap, or is it something more complicated?
Well, with Netflix, it's a little bit more complicated, but and I can't really go into that right now. But
and all the challenges.
But VLC really does do most of the work for you. It's a really great piece of software, and I was really influenced by that kind of wave of the internet. Like, VLC is the best video player online because it's not motivated by profit. My side as well. Like, I'm not motivated by profit. I make a little bit of money off it, but not much. But my main motivation is that everyone has access to the same information, the same. So there's not a premium on the website. There's not. I feel really bad. Like, I use Patreon, and I feel bad when I make exclusive stuff because I know what it's like to not have money. I know what it's like, so I try as much as possible that everyone has free access to that information. I think it's better for everyone. I think when profit motives come in, the quality often tends to drop. So the quality
is hidden behind layers.
Exactly. So as much as possible. Yeah, that's why I like using free software as well, because not only is it free, which is good, but it's also oftentimes better. Sometimes it's hard to get the most to figure it out because it's not the most popular, but really, really important for me, definitely.
I'm totally on your side. What the profit aspect goes, I'm really happy that I don't have to make any money with my podcasting and can do it in my free time and don't have to get money. Of course, like you, I have a Patreon to like finance hosting and domain name and some technical equipment, but it's not a necessity for doing this stuff. And I think of course, many people have fun with financing their life from podcasting or something else. But it always changes. It's not the same. So as soon as you do it for profit, it's a totally different work you do. And a lot of people don't know it beforehand before they start something like that.
Yeah, definitely. It changes why you do it. It changes what you do. It changes everything.
So who are the people who visit FilmGrabber or FilmGrab.com regularly? Are those film buffs like me? Do you know some people who use it for their own film work? What audience do you have?
Well, so it is hard to say. Like I get little bits of information, but people get in touch with me to thank me for the site. So a lot of and I'm really proud of it. A lot of the people who get in touch are using it for the exact same reason I created it, which was to make lookbooks and mood boards to share with their crews. So those people get in touch with me and I'm so happy. So but then other people are just film buffs like yourself, or I don't know, people who like experience looking at things. Like film is a visual medium, but a lot of people don't have the time or interest in spending 2 hours, 2 hours in the cinema, looking at a thing. But maybe they visit my site and take a look at what's there, and that can help them find the next. Oh, this looks interesting, or you know. But for the most part, it seems to be professionals, people working within the industry, which I'm really happy about. Like it's why I started the site. So I couldn't be happier.
So it's really a resource for people who are doing film stuff themselves.
Yeah, but not even just that. Actually, one of my favorite things I just remembered is I've seen a good few people who use it to learn how to draw. They'll just go to the website, pick a random still and give themselves a challenge, you know, a 10 minutes to sketch this or 20 minutes to sketch that. And you see some amazing work. And I'm always really happy when I find people using the site for reasons I couldn't have imagined. Like I couldn't have imagined someone would want to do that, but it's popular enough. I've seen people do it plenty of times. So but then but mainly creating lookbooks and mood boards and stuff. And I've over the past few years now, because I've built the whole archive myself, I've started working with a few people. So different people will send me scripts just so I'll be able to consult on them, and you should check out this movie, and help them gather the resources to create their lookbooks and mood boards, and just to get their project kind of really polished.
So you became a resource yourself, since you
did a little bit, yeah,
and know all the movies that are on the website.
Well, yeah, but just recently, I've had a few people come and contribute a few. So eventually, I'd like more people to come and contribute as well, because there's just so many movies. It can be overwhelming. So when someone gets in touch and says, oh, would you like me to do these kinds of films, and they'll send me a list. And so yeah, I have someone doing kind of blaxploitation movies, because they're working on a project that they need a lot of that imagery anyway. So they're coming to the site now and helping improve it, which is really great. So the first 10 years, yeah, was all me. And now we're moving into a period where I'm more likely to accept some help. So if anyone out there wants to contribute, drop me a line.
Yeah. And we now know how easy it is. You don't need any fancy technical setup or equipment to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I just thought about with TV shows getting more sophisticated and more artistic. I think you could start a TV Grab as well, and maybe
want to contribute there. That's one that's been requested a lot, but just the amount of, I think there's so much high quality TV at the moment that I certainly don't have time to watch it. Like, I still haven't finished The Sopranos yet, so I focus just on film. But yeah, maybe that's a project if someone wants to get in touch, and we'll start TV Grab.
Mm-hmm. That's I'm looking forward to it because I myself I think I watch more TV than I watch movies, and the recent Watchmen show or like say Sopranos or something like that, and then you have even more material and you have to think about, okay, do I now do every episode or do I something for the whole season or for the whole TV show? It's very difficult to decide.
Yeah, it's difficult to know, and different directors for every episode. And,
yes.
Oh yeah, it's a whole can of worms. I'm not ready to open just yet, but hopefully soon.
So I want to go a bit about the philosophical side of cinematography. So I wrote down a question, maybe that's not answerable. What is a good shot? So maybe we can go from the negative side. So what makes a shot not good, or what ways can you see that the shot could have been better? So can you say something about this? Is it possible?
Well, it's hard to say because there's no one technique or no one style that's better or worse than anything else. For me, the thing that annoys me or the thing that disappoints me when I'm watching a film is when I see thoughtlessness. So it's one of the things I really don't like, seeing a camera move on a track and then within the same shot start moving backwards. So it'll move left to right and then reach the end of the track and just start moving backwards. And oftentimes for me, that just indicates, well, they wanted it to look cinematic or impressive, but there's no motivation behind the movement. So for me, what I'm always looking for, I want to know that the filmmakers have thought more about every shot than I am thinking about it when I watch it. So if it's a small handheld close up, if it communicates the right thing, if that moment is just about that, or if it's a huge, huge wide shot, or if it's an 8 minute long tracking shot, as long as you can tell that the filmmakers have made choices and made conscious choices to tell their story, to communicate their ideas in the best way. That's for me good cinematography.
Mm-hmm. So it's not about what they're doing or how they're doing it, but if they thought about what they're doing and not just
pointing
the camera at the actor and just say go.
And just going. Yeah. So I really like back in that year of school when I was watching a lot of movies. I remember I watched Pulp Fiction on DVD, but on the DVD they had a subtitle track And the subtitle track was just full of trivia about the movie. So as you watched it, it would give you different bits of trivia. And there's a moment early on in the movie where they come to the apartment. So they come to the apartment that they're going to bust in and get the suitcase back from. But they look at their watch and realize they're a minute or two early. So they go away from the door. And at that moment, the trivia track said, notice how the camera stays at the door and they walk away. And the camera never follows them fully. It stays at the door. So it reminds us that the door is where we want to be. We're just waiting. We're waiting for the right moment. And at that moment, I really realized that filmmaking in itself, like aside from script, like it was a language in itself. If you used it the right way, you could tell your story completely visually. You could have a great script as well, but you could tell the story just with the visuals. And I find that so often when I'm working on the site, because when I watch True for the second time, I'm not watching True with sound, and I'm watching at a faster pace. Like I'm skipping ahead in scenes where the shots are long. But oftentimes I will find myself a really great scene. I'm as moved by it, without sound, without mm-hmm. dialogue. I'm as moved at it just by the way it's shot, it's the way it's constructed. It's its own language, really. Like,
Yeah, I really like when the people who made the movie tell you something about how they made the movie and what goes into the thinking process. For the same reason, I really like I really love two film documentaries about making a movie. They're both about Star Wars movies.
Okay.
One is about the making of Phantom Menace, because you can see how the movie falls apart while they're making it, and how they started out with this big vision, and we tell the story of young Darth Vader, and we it's like poetry, and we reference the old movies, and then if you go deeper into the documentary, you see how it doesn't work out, and George Lucas really tried to crown his creation, but he really failed to achieve what he wanted to do. And the other is about The Last Jedi, which I personally really liked about what it wanted to tell us about the Star Wars mythology. And I really liked in this movie how the director fought against Mark Hamill's vision of his character, and how the those two people, who the one is the director who should be in charge, and the other is this actor who is connected to the franchise for decades, and they both have different visions about what the movie wants to be, and how Mark Hamill then swallows his pride and says, okay, I'm just the actor and I do what the director wants me to do. I'm not happy with it, but I'm so professional that I just let it happen. And
just
I really like those two documentaries, because they inform so much about the two movies and in some ways make it better or make it more enjoyable.
When you know the struggle behind the images, a really great movie is Burden of Dreams, which is about the making of Fitzcarraldo. It's a really great movie. So Fitzcarraldo is about trying to pull a boat over a hill, and Werner Herzog, in his infinite wisdom, decided the only way to do that is to pull a boat over a hill. So
that's
it's a really
Herzog
great documentary.
Way of doing things.
Yeah.
For the same reason, I really like every documentary about Jaws.
Oh yes,
because it's more entertaining than the movie itself. So if you know that the shark, there's one documentary. It's, I think it's on YouTube. It's called "The Shark Is Working."
Okay.
Where they tell all the stories about what they did when the shark was not working. I think the best character in this documentary is Richard Dreyfuss, because he has so much fun telling about what everything that doesn't work, and how they thought, okay, now we have the most of the movie. We just need to shoot the scene on the boat where they try to kill the shark. And I think this scene alone, or this setting alone, took as long as the whole movie, other part of the movie. And I really love how they, against all odds, shot this damn movie. And the making of is more entertaining than the movie itself, because it has so much more problems to solve than just shooting a shark.
Or
I think it's an apocryphal story, but I really love the story where George Lucas visited the set, crawled inside the shark and broke it.
Oh, and it stopped working.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of movies where the making of is more entertaining than the movie itself. Maybe not a good sign for the movie, but at least we learned something about movie making.
Yeah.
I have a couple of technical things I want to get your opinion about. Thing is, what do you think is the advantage of shooting black and white in the modern day, when you always have the option, so it's not that expensive anymore or technical difficult to shoot in color, but there are a lot of modern filmmakers who opt to shoot in black and white and do very fantastic movies with it, like The Lighthouse or Roma.
Yeah, I was just thinking of The Lighthouse, which is a really great example. So
what do you think is the advantage of shooting in black and white today?
It's one of those things that it's just evocative. It's it evokes something in us, because we know, and increasingly so, the like movies, especially big budget movies, look less and less realistic the more polished they get. Like everything is just perfect and stylized, so it doesn't look real at all. And of course, black and white is never going to look real, because it's a stylistic choice. It used to be a practical choice. Like, they didn't have color film, so black and white was the only way to go. But eventually it becomes a choice that just helps us evoke something else. And what it evokes can change. I mean, you just mentioned two different movies, and two very, very different movies, Roma and The Lighthouse, which are both black and white, both beautiful, but both using the color, or lack of color, to sell something very, very different. I personally prefer The Lighthouse. I think it's a really great movie, and way funnier than it should be. But I think sometimes within art, simplifying things, actually not just within art, within life as well, going simpler often yields better results, or not better results, but more interesting results. So I think that's why filmmakers are going for black and white, because the simplicity of the images, they're not burdened by color theory, they're not burdened by making sure absolutely everything is perfect in terms of the colors presented on screen. It's a lot more simple, it's a lot more pared back. And I guess simplicity is the key with that one. I have shot in black and white, and I guess I was looking for simplicity, and I think that's what you get when you choose to shoot that way.
Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, a lot of people or film buffs complain about more and more movies shot on digital or not on film. And I really never understand what the advantages of a film shoot between compared to a digital shoot was. Maybe I just don't have the eye for it, but what do we lose if we just shoot a film on digital?
Well, you lose a lot less now. Like, I mean, the cameras are getting more and more and more sophisticated, but there is something to be said for the natural feel of the film grain. Digital oftentimes can be too sharp and too cold and clinical, but there are ways around that. Like, I've never shot with actual film, and I don't think I probably ever will, because it's just too damn expensive. And as you can tell, I'm a cheap ass. So, but if you have a digital processor, a digital camera, and you put some old camera lenses in front of it, you soften that coldness, that sharpness, and you get some really, really interesting results. I'm trying to think. I can't, nothing's coming jumping to mind right now, but there are films definitely that are shot digitally, but you wouldn't believe that they were shot digitally, because they're so warm and inviting. But it's a textural thing. And it's like that thing, I don't know, our I don't know from art, but I know when I see it. I don't know from film, but I know when I see it, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I just saw you don't on your website mention if the film was shot on digital or on film. So
for me it's not I mean, a lot of people get caught up with what's a shot on. Oh my god, it's 70 mil IMAX. Oh my god, like, but on if you like, and unless you're making the right asking yourself the right questions in production, why are we doing it? What is this achieving? Like, it doesn't matter what you shoot on. It only matters that you're shooting, you're making the right choices for the right reasons, or you're making choices for the right reasons.
So, last thing, in my personal movie watching workflow, or general in my life, I always try to think of I always try to watch more and more movies made by women. So we have a lot of discussion about female directors and actresses and the whole thing with Harvey Weinstein and all of this. And I think it's now a big discussion, but going back just to the making side of movies, for example, this year I have a running challenge where I try to watch 52 movies by female directors. So like one per week, and try to watch more movies made by women, like directors or the DOPs or something like that. But do you in your work have any sense if women direct or shoot movies differently than men? Do you know some differences or don't?
No, I don't think it's as clear cut as that. But I think most important to remember is that, especially within the canon of kind of accepted masterpieces, it's majority white, it's majority male, and so cinema loses if you're only watching films just by white males, you're only experiencing a certain or a limited scope of what things can be. For me personally, Agnes Varda is the greatest filmmaker ever. She's absolutely amazing, and her films are infused with such empathy, such a sense of humor, just bubbling over with ideas, not just visually but narratively. She was running circles around a lot of the other Nouvelle Vague filmmakers, but she never really got the credit until the last few years of her life. I think it's really important, and it's a really great thing that especially in the last few years the filmmaking discourse has opened up now so much more to voices like not non-white voices, a lot more female filmmakers just offering new perspectives, because we've already told most of the stories we can tell, and we've told them 100 times over. We need to find new ways to tell stories, and I think having as many different perspectives behind the camera and in front of the camera as well only benefits everyone, really does benefit everyone. And I think it's great that you've set yourself that challenge to watch 52 films. And you should really, that there's actually, I think it's just come out on Criterion now, but it was available in France for years, a big collection of all of Agnès Varda's movies. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing, just a stunning body of work, really, really great.
Yes, I think you said it very well that we miss a lot of things if we just stick to, like, say, the mainstream canon of Tarantino and Kubrick movies. And
exactly.
And as much as I love Kubrick movies, there's always something missing, I think, in part of the portrayal of women, especially. Like, for example, I really like The Shining, and I really like what it cinematically and with the cinematography achieved. But if you think about Shelley DeWalt's character in this movie, she's just like the more a prop that's moving than a real character, and it's more about.
And that's it's a real shame, because when you watch her films, the films that she made with Robert Altman, he identified that she was just this stunningly talented actress.
And, yes,
I think Kubrick kind of bullied her, bullied that performance out of her, instead of trusting her as an actress, which is a real shame, because I do love The Shining as well. But I don't think we need to bully people anymore.
That's true. And I think you always, well, I imagine that I always see, even without knowing, when a movie is made by a woman or has a female DOP, because I think it's not that male directors want to malign women or just shoot them one way, but I think they just don't have the education to do it otherwise. So there are some directors, male directors, who can do it, but I think a lot of DOPs or a lot of directors just never learned it differently. And since women have a vastly different experiences, even especially when they try to get into the movie making business, I think they bring a different set of skills to the whole craft.
Yeah, and a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good. So to close out this interview, I want just shortly to talk about something that you yourself talked a lot about on Twitter in the recent days, since came out that another site that do something similar to you, One Perfect Shot, is producing a movie with Ava DuVernay. I think it's a documentary about movie cinematography. And maybe you can just shortly tell what your problem with One Perfect Shot is, what happened there.
Well, we won't dwell on it too long because
I don't want to give it.
Yeah. So basically, like, since I started the website, my philosophy has been it's all free for everyone and everyone can use it however they want. But I do appreciate some credit if someone is using a lot of my work. And it's not my work, obviously, inherently. It's someone else's work. But it's taken a lot of my time and my effort to get it up onto the site. And One Perfect Shot kind of became a very cool Twitter follow like a few years ago because it was such a cool simple idea and they did it really well. But what they also did at that time was take a lot of stuff off my site, and not just my site, a lot of other Twitter users who would post side by sides, they would just repost it without crediting them. So much to the point that I ended up emailing the guy who ran the site and I said, I'm pretty sure you're borrowing a lot of stuff off me and I don't mind that, but you've got a much bigger Twitter following than I do, so maybe you could give me a shout out. And so he got back, we'll do that and let's work together and blah, blah, blah. But nothing ever comes of it. Never got a proper shout out or anything like that. So I've always had tried to live by the philosophy of a rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people really want to get up the ladder, and I'm mixing metaphors here, but a lot of people want to climb the ladder and then kick it out in case anyone else wants to follow them up it. So I've had experiences not just with One Perfect Shot, but also another site called Shot Deck, which is run by a DP, Lawrence Scherr. He got in touch with me years ago to say how much he loves my website. And then this year, someone emailed me and just said, you have to check out this Shot Deck. They've ripped you off so, so much, which is just, yeah, it's kind of deflating because you want to give everything away freely and you hope that the people who take those things receive them in the right spirit, but obviously not. But it's not going to change how I do things at all. I'm going to keep grabbing films and posting them for free, and hopefully the work stands for itself, I guess.
I just wanted to touch on this topic since the news was announced. There was a lot of different people who said One Perfect Shot rips off Film Grab, and there are a lot of other people who don't understand what the problem is. So I just wanted to use this opportunity to, let's say, give an overview about the relationship between you and One Perfect Shot. Also reached out to One Perfect Shot and asked them if they want to comment on it on their side, but they said they don't want to comment on it any further. They said that they had some private messaging with you, and from their side, that's it. I don't want to create more beef with One Perfect Shot than there is. I think that's the situation, and if they want to change it, they can do it. And I think regardless of this, I'm really looking forward to their documentary with Ava DuVernay, since I really love her work and think she is a very good or terrific filmmaker. I don't know if you saw it when they See Us.
I haven't watched that one yet. As I said, TV is just hard to get to. I'm bound to watch as many movies as possible, so I don't get to watch TV as much as I should.
So in the future, if TV Grab gets off the ground.
Exactly.
I think When They See Us needs to be one of the first shows to be on there, since it has terrific filmmaking and really, really frames this the trauma of this people in a very fitting way. So you're like feeling in prison with those people, and that's I think what you wanted to achieve. So I think that's it, and if there's something new, I think the people will know it from you or from One Perfect Shot, but I don't want to end the conversation on the negative note. So in the end, we talked a lot about what you do and what work you put into your website. So the final question would be, how can people support you?
So the best way to support me is to go to patreon.com/filmgrab. As little as $1 a month in the tip jar there goes a long way towards keeping the site going. I guess that's the best way, but really, even if people just share on Twitter or on Facebook or Instagram, wherever you share things, if you get a lot of your stills from FilmGrab, just put a little FilmGrab credit on there, and that's the best way, because it does take a lot of work, and I hate to close things on a negative note, but it takes a lot of work, and I'm proud of the work, but it is disheartening when just stuff like that happens. I guess.
So you have your Patreon. You also mentioned that you start to collaborate with people on the site. So if people want to reach out and say, oh, I have the time, I have the film experiences to do some movie myself, can you just mail to you, or how is the best way to reach you?
Yeah, you can find my contact details on the FilmGrab website. And also, I guess if people want a consultant who has built a huge library of stills, if you're working on a project and need to put together mood boards or a lookbook, get in touch as well, because it's work I really enjoy doing, reading people's scripts and helping them find their resource images.
So yes, so if I want people to get in touch with you, so I will link your contact site. You're also not just on Twitter, but on Instagram and Facebook. So you're all on all the social media, you're represented.
Yeah. It's a lot of work, but
yeah, I know that social media is its own job. So thank you so much for doing this, for taking the time. I really enjoyed our conversation. I really learned a lot about movie making and on cinematography. And I'm looking forward to every day to see a new movie grabbed by you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this was a pleasure and a long time coming. I'm glad it went well.
Yeah, I'm really glad we finally did this. So, if you're a listener, you will find all the links in the show notes. If you listen on a platform like, say, Spotify, some platforms don't support show notes. I will put a link in the description where you can find the show notes, so you don't need to search around on Google to find all the things we mentioned. And I hope you enjoyed this interview, and have a good day. Bye.
Das war die neue Folge vom Podcast Die KulturpessimistInnen. Unter kultpess.de findet ihr alle Möglichkeiten zur Kontaktaufnahme und zur Unterstützung von Becky, Christopher und Erik. Ihr erreicht sie bei Twitter, Facebook oder per Mail. Der Podcast steht unter einer Creative Commons Share Alike Lizenz. Wir hoffen, ihr seid auch beim nächsten Mal wieder mit dabei.